A Board of Regents task force responds to calls from South Dakota lawmakers. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, June 15th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Board of Regents Executive Director Brian Maher. We'll talk about Senate Bill 55 and cost efficiencies in higher ed. We then explore the natural world from the perspective of South Dakota children. Scientist Megan Jarko is with us to talk about land use explorer kits. We hear from people who live in the small town treasure of Alcester. We compare essential speeches from Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan for a look at liberalism and conservatism. We also invite you into the world of opera. That is coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Legislation to repeal 11 federal laws targeting Native Americans is headed to the U.S. House. South Dakota Republican Mike Rounds introduced the Respect Act in the Senate, where it passed unanimously. The bill has support from the Great Plains Tribal Chairmen's Association and the National Congress of American Indians. The laws targeted for repeal are discriminatory toward Native Americans. One allows authorities to force indigenous children into reform schools. Round says the outdated laws are appalling and immoral. Even though the pandemic is easing, households are still trying to recover from the crisis. The Federal Communications Commission is providing a relief program to help pay internet bills. SDPB's Kyle Ireland reports.
The Emergency Broadband Benefit is an FCC program to help households struggling to afford internet service during the COVID-19 pandemic. For those eligible, internet service providers will deduct $50 from the bill every month. This will last until the program runs out of money or the pandemic is declared over by health officials. Marty Newell is Chief Operating Officer at the Center for Rural Strategies. He says high-speed broadband access isn't a luxury, but a necessity.
You got to have it to do business. You got to have it to go to school. You got to have it to check with your doctor. You've got to have it to apply for benefits. You've got to have it to apply for a job.
Newell says the EBB program received strong support from both sides of the aisle.
Nobody in Washington that says we need less accessible and more expensive internet service for my constituents.
695 households in South Dakota have enrolled in the program so far. Rural South Dakotan Jessica Shop says the effort has been a big help for her family after struggling with spotty connections.
My kids had to go into, during the pandemic, they had to go into town and sit in the parking lots to be able to do their homework.
The FCC reports that 95% of South Dakotans have high-speed internet access. That number falls to 89% for rural populations. Low-income households and people who make less than $198,000 could be eligible for the program. For more information on eligibility and how to apply, visit ebbhelp.org or call the program's hotline at 833-511-0311. Reporting for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
Two groups have merged to support entrepreneurs and startups in Sioux Falls. The Zeal Center for Entrepreneurship will merge with and take the name of Startup Sioux Falls. The nonprofit has new branding, a new website, and plans to move downtown. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more.
Matt Paulson is a business leader in Sioux Falls. He said it didn't make sense for the city to have two organizations that focus on supporting startups and entrepreneurs.
We knew we would be stronger if we combined efforts. You know, for the organization to be successful in the future, it really needed to combine the best aspects of Zeal and the best aspects of Startup Sioux Falls into one organization.
Paulson made his comments at a Sioux Falls Rotary Club event with Brian Manor, who heads the new Startup Sioux Falls. Manor says the merger creates a more streamlined approach to the city's economics. Startup Sioux Falls offers business accelerator, networking, and mentorship programs. The building is located on the northwest side of Sioux Falls, but will move to the downtown area to be more accessible. For SDPB, I'm Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
For today's weather, we're seeing sunny skies statewide. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Journalist Mark Walker is a former South Dakotan. He was an investigative reporter for Argus Leader Media. He was known for his work uncovering the backlog of court-ordered mental health exams in the state's jails. South Dakota Supreme Court Justice David Gilbertson cited Walker's reporting as a catalyst for addressing the court delays statewide. Now Walker works for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. He was part of a team of journalists that reported on the federal response to the coronavirus pandemic. The staff of the New York Times was a finalist in the national reporting category for this year's Pulitzer Prizes. They were honored for their, quote, detailed reporting on how the Trump administration consistently failed to respond properly or adequately to the coronavirus threat, including downplaying the severity, end quote. Mark Walker is joining us now. Mark, welcome back to South Dakota here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on today.
And congratulations on your work and the other acknowledgement for different parts of the New York Times staff that have been mentioned in the Pulitzer Prizes. But I want to focus on your part of this team and the work that you did covering the CDC and the federal response. Take me back to some of those early days in your work and how that reporting started. When did you sort of know that you were having, you were working on a bigger project, something that was unfolding over time?
You know, I think in the early months of the year, we were sort of still kind of figuring out how big of a story the pandemic would be. But as we got sort of mid to late February, it was kind of hit us that this is going to be a really incredibly big deal. So one of the things that I was tasked with is trying to collect every possible document, every conversation taking place on the local, state, and federal levels. And so I set out, you know, spent nights, mornings, weekends, putting in public records requests to cities across the country. I think I put in records requests to every single state across the country to collect documents that would give us a behind-the-curtains look at how the pandemic was unfolding.
So you're reporting on this before you really know, you know, in retrospect, as you look back now at not only the reporting of the team, but also in what we all know now about COVID-19, what were some of the early decisions that you think you made that were really smart? And what would you go back and say, oh, if I had known this, I would have known to look behind that door?
You know, one of the decisions that I made early that I thought paid off tremendously for us was my sort of strategy and how I was going to collect these documents. I think initially everyone's thought was to put in FOIAs and put in records requests with the CDC, with HHS, you know, the large federal agencies. But having an experience dealing with them, I knew that was going to take, you know, months, if not a year or more, to get those records back. So I made the decision to go down to the city level. So I would put in records requests with city mayors, city health departments, county health departments, a lot of those different FOIA shops who don't really get records requests that often. And I FOIA'd their communications with the federal government. So I was able to capture some of those conversations. And I think it played out pretty well. And we were able to get a real inside look at how the pandemic was playing out.
If I could take a step back and
something I would have done differently, and maybe I would have filed a few FOIA lawsuits early on against the federal government, knowing that those were going to take a while, but just get those started much earlier than I did.
Yeah. Would you say that you work in South Dakota with the Argus Leader, kind of working at that city level, covering, you know, courts and criminal justice? Did that help prepare you for the kind of work that you would end up doing because it helped you figure out that local sourcing was going to be key to telling this bigger story?
Yes, I always think back to my time at the Argus, talking to my former colleague, Patrick Anderson, when we used to just sort of joke around, like being a reporter, investigative reporter in South Dakota is kind of like walking around with a weighted vest. It's just difficult no matter what you do. So I think that helped me sort of prepare to know, to try and find ways and open doors around any sort of challenge or obstacle that it overcame. Just that level of difficulty that it took to access key pieces of information definitely prepared me for where I am today.
What insight do you have for our listeners that would kind of get at this idea of the role of journalists during this kind of crisis? Because so much of what the end user or the news consumer sees is, you know, a headline that maybe they don't even end up reading the full piece. When we got to this level of national crisis, how important were the role of large teams of journalists who were doing this sort of granular kind of research and reporting?
You know, I think it's very important for a historical standpoint and sort of assessing the impact for the Pulitzer that we won for public service. One of the projects that was submitted was our national data tracker, where we sort of like tracked all the coronavirus cases. And we're able to see that a large number of the early cases came from nursing homes, that a lot of the folks who died very early, who got really sick and never stood a chance, and where the virus just sort of swept through, were nursing homes. Without the Times doing that very detailed work, there would probably not be that spotlight on the neglect of nursing homes over the last decades, the need to sort of reform, the need to sort of put in additional measures to keep, you know, people's family members safe. And I think our detailed look and shedding light, it wasn't to make someone look bad. It was to shed light on an issue that needed to be looked at and needed to be changed and reformed.
Mark Walker is a reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, former Argus Leader reporter. You can find him on Twitter at @ByMarkWalker. And Mark, you're welcome back anytime on South Dakota Airwaves to talk about the work that you continue to do. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Ahead on the program, encouraging young explorers to understand and conserve the land where they live. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state. Informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Hallett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. How do we explore the science of place? Megan Jarko is an associate professor of the USD Department of Sustainability and Environment. She's joining us today to talk about a National Science Foundation collaboration that aims to invite kids into the world of science in their own lived spaces. And Dr. Jarko is joining us from the SDPB studios in Vermilion. Megan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The first thing I want to know about is this water, agriculture, food, energy research nexus. Tell me about that collaboration and project, which is where these land use explorer kits can be found.
Yes, so that we call it the WaferX project, and it is a large, so a $6 million grant from the National Science Foundation that's a partnership between Montana State, University of Wyoming, and the University of South Dakota. And the main premise of the grant is looking at, so in this big region of the Upper Missouri River Basin where agriculture and energy extraction are the dominant land uses. What would be our capacity to both sequester carbon through bioenergy or sequestering carbon underground? And then what would be the trade-offs between then, if you did a lot of that on this landscape, what would be trade-offs with food, you know, other land uses, biodiversity, and things like that?
Talk a little bit about this intersection between, you know, land uses that also include the humans that are walking around in this space or the cattle that are walking. It's not just, it's a really multifaceted approach. Help us understand why that's so critical to your work.
Yeah, so again, if we're saying the Upper Missouri River Basin, so that's most of South Dakota, a lot of North Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana, that is a huge amount of land that doesn't have a lot of people. I mean, we're some of the least densely populated area in the United States. And so the land gets really intensively used for agriculture. But of course, there are people here who use the landscape, and it's, you know, farmers and landowners and ranchers. And so our landscapes are really important for people's incomes, but it's also really important for, you know, a range of other residents and people who come to this area for tourism, which is another really big industry. And so looking at these trade-offs between sometimes what's best for agriculture, you know, isn't as good, let's say, for some types of recreation. And so there are these trade-offs in our landscape, and to be able to, so, you know, with this grant, it is a really interdisciplinary research team. So we could look at different aspects of, you know, how does this affect carbon cycling? How does it affect biodiversity? How does it affect, you know, people's values?
Yeah. Why kids? Tell me about the Land Use Explorers Kits, and why is it important to invite kids into this conversation?
Good. Thanks. So the overall grant is really a modeling with some fieldwork grant, so this really strong research focus that doesn't necessarily, you know, a lot of it isn't geared towards, let's say, the public, but these have really important implications. And so how we think about the land, how we plan for the future is really important, and we need to invite the public into those conversations. And I think especially kids are really important to involve in those conversations. And so, you know, for example, my part of this larger research project was the part of understanding different residences' values towards their landscape. And so with this youth kit, what we wanted to do is see how kids, you know, what do we want to see on our landscape? What are some of the trade-offs that we, you know, would have between if we had one land use versus another? And so I think kids are really important because, one, I don't know that we always ask the questions of people. You know, kids might just look at the landscape and think, you know, if you're around Vermilion, oh, it just always has been corn and soybean, and it always will, you know, be dominated by corn and soybean. And so making sure we have conversations about, you know, what do we have now? What did we have in the past? What might we like to have in the future? So we have a more informed public about, you know, being able to have conversations about the trade-offs, because, you know, you can't have every land use be beneficial for everything.
From your perspective, and we're going to talk about these kits a little bit more and how people can get them in their hands and use them and how they're fun and all the sorts of things that we think about when we think about education and curriculum for children. But this is not about just keeping kids busy or checking something off the box. These kids are going to grow up, and some of them are going to be the future scientists or the future political leaders or the future artists in South Dakota. What do you hope grows out of some of these early efforts that you're planting now?
One of the efforts of this is to help kids see themselves as scientists, and hopefully we can continue to expand that. But one anecdote is, so I grew up and I have a twin sister who happens to be exceptional at kind of the humanities and social science, and I think in any metric would have been smarter than me. So I didn't know that people perceived scientists as being smarter, or maybe like, oh, I couldn't be a scientist, they're too smart. And I had no idea that people believed that. And so now that I realize that some people have that belief, and it's actually relatively widespread, we really want to help counter that. Anyone can be a scientist. And in fact, different ways of thinking make science better. And so we've had a bad history of encouraging certain people to be in the sciences, and it's not necessarily very equitable. And so one of the focal areas of this is to help people see that there's a lot of different ways to be a scientist, and in fact, you know, we need a lot of people, and so to help with telling that story with youth.
We are going to put some links up to more information on our website about this kit. But tell people a little bit who has access to it. What are you, who's the audience for this, and how do you foresee these kits being rolled out?
Yeah, so the kits include a booklet. There's the materials that you would need to do the kits. Right now, I would say it's more of a pilot program. So we have 500 of the kits that are freely available. We would like to get them into the hands of, at this point, we're looking for people who lead youth groups. And anywhere within the state of South Dakota, people would be on the links that get posted. People can request kits, and you can request as many as you would need for, you know, whatever groups people are working with. They're roughly for the ages 9 to 13. So you can think of older elementary school through middle school. And then people can request them. We have a short survey that if people would complete, that would be great, because our hope is we can learn from this first round of kits, make them better, and then have this be an even larger program where we can, you know, provide more of this information to, and, you know, hopefully fun to people throughout the region.
Yeah. Professor Jerko, we hope to have you back again in the program to talk more about Way4X. There's all kinds of exciting things happening there. So welcome back anytime. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Ahead on the program, Senate Bill 55 in 2020 called for a task force to study higher education in South Dakota. We'll talk about those task force recommendations. Brian Maher is with us. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Hi, I'm Julie Overgaard, Executive Director of SDPB. The Sound Vision campaign is allowing us to get the message out of our high-quality programming. SDPB is the golden standard of public broadcasting and is critical to getting the news, stories, and entertainment of South Dakota to South Dakotans. A gift to the Sound Vision campaign will give SDPB the opportunity to reach deeper into our community to share these amazing stories and entertainment. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and help build community one story at a time. Be as generous as you can. No matter the amount, you power this station to serve all of us. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Give online at sdpb.org/donate or call 800-333-0789. Again, 800-333-0789. And thank you so much for your support.
Start your day with credible news and information from NPR and SDPB. Join host John Wynn for Morning Edition, weekdays on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The 2020 South Dakota legislative session included the passage of Senate Bill 55. It called for a task force to examine cost effectiveness in the state's six public universities. Well, the task force has now issued its recommendations. Brian Maher is the executive director of the South Dakota Board of Regents, and he's returning to In the Moment with an update. Brian Maher, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Yes, Lori, good to talk to you, and thanks for having me on.
For people who haven't been following this story closely, what do you think some of the intentions were of Senate Bill 55? What were lawmakers looking for at the time?
You know, I think there was just kind of a general approach originally as they looked at this and said, you know, we spend a lot of money as a state. We appropriate a whole lot of money into higher education, into our public universities. And we want to make sure that that money is getting spent as wisely as it can be spent. So I think that was kind of the broad theme. And then they what they did was they said, let's have a task force look at this and see if indeed we are spending the money wisely and if there's any way we can gain efficiencies in how we are spending that money.
All right, we're looking at a series of recommendations at this point. It's pretty extensive. Pull out some of the highlights that you think address some of the original intent of SB 55, and then let's talk about some of the surprises that maybe you found that as you, you know, created an approach to allow for things that you hadn't thought of before. So first, some of the big recommendations that you think would address things that people were really hoping to, you know, hang their hats on with this thing.
Well, I think, I think one thing that came from this, Lori, that probably wasn't an original outcome was really a relationship that evolved and developed between the Board of Regents and members of the legislature. So we had four members of the legislature as part of the task force. And I think that relationship and that ability to communicate between the State House and the Board office really is critical and can't be overstated how important that is. I know that's not about money, it's not about dollars and cents, but it's a critical piece that came out of this. So I would start mm-hmm. with that result. Next, I would say there are a number of areas that we're really looking at. Chief among them, I would say, as you were asking the question, the one that jumped to the front of mind would be, how are we going to use our community colleges that exist both in Sioux Falls and in Rapid City? And while I can't tell you specifically what we're going to do differently, I can tell you we have a number of options on the table for consideration that we will look at implementing to better utilize those two facilities. So that would be a big piece of this puzzle immediately.
Yeah. How about some of the things that you found that maybe were a bit more surprising that came organically out of this relationship building and the information gathering phase of this?
Yeah. One would be just in terms of our building processes. We have a number of things a number of hoops that we have to jump through in order to build on our campuses. And one of the legislators who I had mentioned in general earlier, Senator Ryan Maher from Isabel, actually put a bill in this last year that eased some of those restrictions for us to be able to build. And I would have never anticipated that a year ago when we were thinking about what might come through. But that was part of the relationship building and the ability to communicate and work together to see something like that go through. So that's already done and was a direct result of Senate Bill 55.
All right. For our listeners, relation between Brian Maher and Ryan Maher, you're not related.
We are not related. Thanks for pointing that out.
All right. There has...
In fact, a year ago, we didn't know one another.
So a lot of, news has, water has gone under the bridge since this whole thing started with things like patriotic education and diversity efforts. How did, being in that relationship when you get a letter from the governor, being in the process of this task force and having those closer relationships, how did that change, the result of, a letter from the governor comes or there's a new initiative that has to be evaluated system-wide? How did that impact the kind of conversations that you had first is what I'm wondering.
I think it aided in the conversation because those relationships were becoming stronger as we went, and we were able to, I think, have conversations that were more candid than maybe they would have been previously, or certainly for me, not having the relationship at all a year ago. I think it assisted in that conversation. And what you bring up, Lori, really highlights that while Senate Bill 55 was going on all through this past year, our day-to-day activities and our what was going on in our campuses and what was going on in our board office, those things never ceased. So you still had to continue the day-to-day work along with keeping an eye on what's happening with Senate Bill 55.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about some of those diversity or inclusion efforts. Are there recommendations from this task force for consolidation or elimination of those programs?
No, that's not a recommendation that came out of this. And I would tell you that as the concepts of diversity and inclusion come up, those are certainly top of mind nationally. And here in South Dakota and with the Board of Regents, we're no exception to that. But that's a separate issue from Senate Bill 55.
Can you tell me, just because it's you and me and all our listeners, of course, but what's the fuss about with that? Why are so people, you know, you've sat on both sides of this and you've had a lot of those conversations. How would you walk me through if I just said, I don't understand what people are so upset about in these programs when they talk about mission creep or elimination or how much that more is needed? What are you hearing as you listen intently to different people that they are worried about in this broader conversation about diversity and inclusion?
Boy.
I know that's a really tough question.
You know, it's emotionally charged.
Okay.
I hear that with a great frequency. And honestly, I hear people with different points of view really asking that same question. Yeah. What is the big deal? And I hear that from people who might be squarely on one side of the topic, and I hear it from people who might be squarely on the other side of the topic. So I think maybe the big deal is we need to continue conversations and just kind of get to the core of having an understanding of what it is that we're talking about, and we might begin just with some definitions of just what it is that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I'm just being super vulnerable right now with you because I'm one of those people who was asked that question, like, and I've said to people, I don't get it. And sometimes when I say that, you know, I'm met with a little bit of agitation, like, if you don't get it, you're not paying attention. And I'm like, no, I really am trying. I'm trying to see where this all comes from. And I'm wondering if people are bringing their own educational experience to the conversation. And so I come from this background where, you know, I had this great history teacher in high school named Tom Lubeck, who really just taught us to think critically about all kinds of things. I love reading history books. I do this show and I talk about South Dakota history all the time. I graduated from Augustana, where we just really, you know, thought about how we live in our community and, you know, did these great capstone projects. And my daughter had a great history teacher, Rebecca Kelly. And so maybe I'm just bringing to the table all these good stories, and I'm not open enough to where some things are going wrong. Do you think that when, as part of this task force, just more broadly speaking, when people come to the table, that they bring all of that, their own, you know, experiences with a good teacher or a bad teacher, or, you know, their own thoughts about history, that it's a whole muddy mess that we bring when we sit down and talk about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. You know, I think it's hard at any point in time to really take off your shoes and try to put on somebody else's shoes. So I think absolutely we come to the table with our own set of experiences and our own lens that we look at life through.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that you, as Executive Director of Board of Regents, help people sit in the same room and do. Let's talk a little bit about what happens next. Now that these recommendations have been offered, what are some final steps? Because it is a very comprehensive look at everything from IT to course offerings to those community colleges to contract processing and HR forms. How does this all spiral forward?
Geez, Laura, you're reminding me of how much work we have to do yet. There's a lot there yet. You know, I think of when I break down Senate Bill 55, you know, and a year ago, it's like, what is this animal? And how do we try to wrap our arms around it? And really, I think it has three stages to it. One we've completed, and that was the task force itself, where we had five meetings around the state. We involved members from our campus institutions, members of the legislature, and citizens from around the state. And we had five good meetings to come up with some of those recommendations that you were just talking about. But that's just one stage of what I think are three stages to be completed. The second stage is the completion of the report. And if you'll remember through Senate Bill 55 that we are mandated to have a report completed and delivered to the governor and to the legislature by November. We'll certainly meet that deadline well in advance of that deadline. But I would say that the meeting of the task force and the development of the report really are of the three issues, probably the two least important of the three issues. And the third issue is the implementation of the recommendations and how do we implement. And we'll do that from through a series of things. Number one, we'll go public with the document so we can be held accountable for what is in that report. But also, we'll embed much of what you see in that strategic plan or in Senate Bill 55 into our strategic plan this fall. So we'll be working to on the implementation stage of Senate Bill 55 for, I would say, at least several years. And then my guess is down the road, we'll probably have a new Senate Bill 55 iteration that comes along, and we'll do something like this again.
Yeah, part of the process. Well, Brian Maher, Executive Director of the Board of Regents, you're always such a great guest. I appreciate your ability to lay out the basics and then wade into the deep end as we all kind of grapple with these big issues and what's at stake and how to have deep, meaningful conversations about them with each other. So thanks for doing that, and we always appreciate your time.
Always a joy, Lori. Thank you.
Let's take a moment now and head to Alcester, South Dakota. Alcester sits about 45 minutes south of Sioux Falls and about 45 minutes north of Sioux City. It's not a bedroom community so much as it is a small town treasure. Alcester was platted in 1879. The city's name honors Colonel Alcester of the British Army. Well, as part of SDPB's Coming Home initiative, we conducted a series of focus groups where participants were offered a small stipend to spend time talking about the places they call home. One of those focus groups gathered longtime residents of Alcester. They remembered their past, but they're also hoping to see the community grow and provide more services to its residents. Today, we hear from Donna Anderson and David Larson. They'll talk here about how they came to make Alcester their home, what they love about living in South Dakota, and what they love about working together in unity.
David Larson, I've lived in Alcester since 1976. Got married and moved into our house here in 1977, and still here. They haven't run me out of town yet. And I was a music teacher here for a while. I finished my career in West Sioux in Haywarden. The last few years I taught, and I've been retired for about 10 or 12 years. Two things that were important, or that I thought were unique when I moved to town here in the 70s, the band shell was still down not too far from Main Street. That's where the community band did their concerts. And then there was the Swenson Car Museum. Three or four buildings full of the weirdest, most unusual vehicles that you could ever imagine. And that's no longer there. When Cliff Swenson passed away, it was liquidated and probably moved to a lot of different places, but it was quite an attraction. People came from a lot of different parts of the country to see the Swenson Car Museum.
What the community needs most of all, and what we have been fortunate to have in the past, is this core of group of people that are willing to work together, and their goal is to make our community better. And I am thinking especially of the McHelps family that we've had. It goes way back to the beginning of our church. They were a family that devoted their life, and the only thing that they had in mind was not to make big money. It was to make this community great. And through the ages, we had Mac back during the 30s. Then we had his son, Roger. And then we had Gary. And they operated the home bank here, which was the hub of our city. Friendship, people are friendly when you're in a small community. Everybody knows you and you know them, which has pros and cons, but it's just a great place to be out here in the Midwest.
You'll see more from the SDPB Coming Home initiative this summer. Find all the details on our website at sdpb.org. Ahead on the program, a festival of talks, a festival of curiosity. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state, informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Howlett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding by the Black Hills Playhouse, presenting the marvelous Wonderettes, a jukebox musical featuring the unforgettable girl group songs of the 50s and 60s, June 18th through July 4th. Tickets and information at blackhillsplayhouse.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In his 1979 speech, Crisis of Confidence, Jimmy Carter blamed America's materialistic culture for weakening our collective sense of national purpose. 4 months later, Ronald Reagan, announcing his candidacy for president, said our biggest problem was big government. Dr. Nick Drummond examines these two important speeches as a way of explaining and understanding the history of the relationship between republicanism and liberalism in American politics, and it is all part of this week's Festival of Talks at Black Hills State University in Spearfish, where Dr. Drummond is assistant professor of political science. Nick, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about why you chose these two men and these two speeches to explain this broader concept.
Well, I guess the real question I'm investigating is collective sacrifice. Is that something that's still possible in America? And there are a number of reasons to doubt this that get a lot of play, which are the political and cultural divisions. But what I'm focusing on is hyper-individualism. And the period of time I'm looking at, I think you can really see this come alive, which is the Carter and Reagan years. Just a fascinating moment in American history. The country's still reeling from Vietnam. The shadow of Watergate still hanging over us. Inflation's going to skyrocket. And then there's this energy crisis initiated by OPEC in response to U.S. support of Israel. And OPEC will continue to flex its muscles throughout 1979, raising oil prices something like 3 or 4 more times. And it's at this juncture that Carter is going to deliver his malaise speech or his crisis of confidence speech. And I dig into that in my talk, and then I will also dig into Reagan's response to that.
Is this the same speech where he wears the sweater and, you know, sits by the fire talking about, I remember the sweater speech. I don't remember it, but I remember reading about the sweater speech. Is this the same time frame, same kind of idea?
Same time frame, same idea going on. That may have been a little bit earlier, the cardigan sweater moment. Carter's also going to throw on some solar panels on top of the White House, turn down the White House thermostat as an effort to really encourage energy conservation. And that's really what is going to motivate Carter to go to the microphones and criticize the American people, is that he's tried to inspire them with energy conservation, again, with a number of speeches, and it's not getting much traction. So instead, he goes to the microphones and says, well, look, the problem is your hedonistic culture, Americans. You're materialistic. You've lost your way. You used to be a people of hard work, family, religion, community. But now it's all about consumption. This is what defines you. And because of that, you're nihilistic. You're empty vessels. You don't have anything to inspire you to greatness or to collective sacrifice. And that is why you're not stepping up to the plate for me in terms of energy conservation.
Yeah. How'd that work out for him? From a presidential? What did Reagan see in that moment that he wanted to capitalize?
Right. So initially, so I'm talking about data right after the speech, the Americans actually received the speech quite well and were inspired to do something. They said they would embrace a kind of rationing program, that they would cut back on their own spending. They didn't want to pay any taxes or tariff, an energy tax. But there was some movement there. But then his popularity is just going to take a hit because inflation continues to rise. And then you have the Iranian hostage crisis situation. Yeah. And then you have Reagan, who's going to step up and see an opportunity, as you alluded to say, well, wait a minute. Actually, materialism has been America's strength. Sure, we can have energy efficiency, but we need to think about growing. We need to think about embracing capitalism, letting it loose. And that's the real problem, according to Reagan, is that it's been too much government oversight, regulation, wasteful government spending. And if we unshackle individualism and capitalism, then that will grow us out of this problem and really, I guess, nurture or at least allow us to think about religion, community. He's going to hit the same themes as Carter in terms of these cultural institutions, religion, community, family, which he sees as being held back by, again, the big government explanation.
Yeah, he flips this and says it's not confidence in ourselves that we've lost or confidence in America as an exceptional nation. It's confidence in you that we've lost, in your government, and your government policies. And how do people respond to Reagan's speech?
They responded very well to that. I think they were looking for a more optimistic message. Again, still reeling from Vietnam, now feeling vulnerable because of the power that that OPEC is now wielding, and they wanted, and then again, the Iranian hostage crisis, they wanted a champion and someone who said, our better days are ahead of us. And this would be one of his messages, that morning is here again in America. I think they responded very well to that messaging.
Is this more than just two men fighting for the White House? This is something that we see the effects of today when we talk about liberalism or conservatism. Help us understand that a little bit.
Yeah, and I want to be clear on terms here.
Yeah,
so in the talk, I talk about liberalism, and what I mean is what scholars today call classical liberalism, which is an emphasis really on the individual, this idea that we can have a regime of rational actors, law-abiding actors who are really looking out for their own economic interests and that is sufficient, or republicanism, when I mean small R republicanism, really hearkening back to kind of ancient Rome, ancient Greece, this notion of being committed to the republic. Today, we probably better understand this as the common good, that these two core ideologies have always been in tension. Carter is saying we've tilted too far in the direction of liberalism. And again, liberalism, I mean more kind of individualism. And Reagan saying, actually, no, we need to go further in that direction and unshackle it, and that'll grow us out. I think this is just throughout American history and today are in constant tension with one another, individualism versus this kind of notion of a common good America.
Have they metastasized in a way that is unhealthy, that we are, you know, that we almost have turned them into these bumper sticker ideas of, big government, small government, or, you know, individual responsibility, individual freedom? Like, what are you seeing compared to then? Has it always been like this, or is it sort of harsher now, that dividing line, than it used to be?
Good question, and one I probably couldn't answer in a single phone call. As a political scientist, I always try to quantify everything, so trying to find data that can be helpful. There is a fascinating study by the Higher Education Research Institute, and it's found that in the late 80s, 74% of college freshmen said that being better off financially was very important to them. Right? And only 42% in that same survey said that developing a meaningful philosophy of life was important. If you go back to the late 60s, you would essentially reverse those numbers. Far more college freshmen were interested in developing this kind of philosophy of life that would bring them happiness. Materialism just wasn't as important. But we can see, if you can recall Wall Street and the Gordon Gekko speech, greed is good. The 80s, we do really see that kind of yuppie materialism take off. And I would argue excessive in perhaps dangerous ways, because it does seem to atomize us, separate us, break down any kind of social capital. And you could, again, refer to the data of Robert Putnam's famous social capital study. Mm-hmm. And he sees the trends really of civic engagement groups, by which I mean the Girl Scouts or Red Cross or parent-teacher associations, all those civic engagement groups, their membership peaks in the 1960s, and then it's just a downward trend thereafter, through the Carter years, through the Reagan years, even through the 90s. And I think that's where we're heading, this hyper-individualism. We're atomized, we're living these meaningless, nihilistic lives, and because of that, we cannot make the kind of collective sacrifices that are sometimes demanded of us.
Interesting stuff. You are going to want to go to that whole festival of talks offering. Nick Drummond is assistant professor of political science at Black Hills State University in Spearfish, and that presentation of his is part of this week-long festival of talks, and his is Thursday morning at 10 Mountain Time at Black Hills State University's Joy Center. Thanks, Nick. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Opera is an art form often misunderstood, and it can be intimidating to enter the world of opera performance as an audience member even. Well, learn how to understand and appreciate this complex art form during the festival talks at Black Hills State University. World-famous soprano Johanna Meyer and music professor Nancy Roberts are going to make it understandable through their presentation called An Easy Introduction to Opera, and we have Johanna with us now. Johanna, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
You have such a storied career, lots of experience, and I just really want to know first, you make your debut with the New York City Opera in 1965, but when did you start experiencing opera? Like, what's one of your earliest memories about seeing it or hearing it for the first time?
Well, I was raised in a family which liked and appreciated opera from my earliest days, and so it was not anything that was new to me. I had been listening to the Metropolitan Opera broadcast since I was a very small child, and had seen opera in Europe with family visits there. And prior to my debut with New York City Opera, I had been studying at the University of Miami in Florida and also at the Manhattan School of Music, and I had made my debut with the Miami Opera early on and toured the country with small opera companies prior to the New York City Opera debut.
Yeah, your stage debut was like 5 weeks old. You're on stage.
that was not in an opera. That was with the Black Hills Passion Play, which was my family's business.
Yeah, so Johanna, tell me a little bit then, and we're going to bring Nancy Roberts into the conversation as well. Nancy, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Because I want to get at this idea from both of you, but we'll ask Johanna first, of inviting new people who don't have this experience with the arts, who didn't grow up, listening to or participating in any kinds of arts experience. They see opera and they see a barrier. They don't know how to enter that space. Johanna, what is one of the ways that in this talk you hope to invite more people into opera?
Well, they need to know that, first of all, opera is not an elite form of entertainment. It has been around for hundreds of years and enjoyed by families, young people, and older generation for many years. And so it's not something that should be approached with trepidation. It takes a little bit of ingenuity and preparation to be prepared for what you are going to see and hear. But it's a very approachable art form, actually.
Yeah. Dr. Roberts, if you're interested in it, then it's for you. So there is no barrier there. But what are some of your tips as far as seeking out opera performances or recording and, making yourself comfortable in that space?
Well, it's a wonderful age now because the Met has broadcast, and there's a subscription that people can get. And during the pandemic, they started having one broadcast a week for free for everybody.
We're talking about television.
Television, right.
Yeah.
And because the Met's been broadcasting on radio for years, of course. But it's on television. And actually, I have an app which works just like any other app with Apple TV. And so I can watch any Met broadcast that I want. And I think a lot of times people don't realize that all of these opera broadcast are subtitled, so it would be just like watching a movie with subtitles.
Yeah. Johanna, tell me a little bit about some of the key operas to, or composers or performers to seek out. Is it better? I mean, like, you know, obviously seeing something in person to me would be ideal, but are there essential playlists of sorts of things to seek out if you want to experience certain operas or certain performances?
Well, I think it is probably a good idea to approach opera from some of its more familiar productions, let's say Carmen or La Boheme or some of the Mozart operas are very accessible. They have interesting stories and they are visually interesting. Some of the later operas may be a little bit more challenging to approach and to listen to, but certainly if one is ready to hear melody and interesting story and beautiful productions and costumes, it's an easy entrance into the world of opera.
Nancy, from the perspective of how this art form really influences our culture or, you know, speaks in conversation with political movements over history or what have you, how is opera part of this larger dialogue that we have with the arts?
Well, I think opera, like anything else, reflects the culture of its day. And one of the things that I notice with it is how topical many things still are. So there's a two-person opera that I've taken out to many high schools called The Telephone, and it's about a young man that's unable to propose to his girlfriend because she won't get him the phone. And this is something that was written in the 60s, and it's more topical now than it was then. I mean, when I was growing up as a teenager in the 1980s, I didn't know anybody that was on the phone for hours at a time. But now it's become so, you know, prevalent in our society that I think not only the operas that they're writing currently, which sometimes are written even about current events or things that happen, but the operas from 200 years ago that have still relevance today. I think it's a very exciting art form in that way.
Well, I would go to this talk just to be in the same room as Johanna Meyer, and so I highly recommend it. It's called An Easy Introduction to Opera with Johanna and Nancy Roberts, and it is this afternoon, 2:30 Mountain at Black Hills State University as part of the Festival of Talks, which runs through Thursday, and it's located in the Joy Center. Dr. Roberts, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Johanna Meyer, thank you as well. Come back again, please.
Yes, I'll just give one little bit of information.
Very
Our
quickly.
Presentation is going to be in Meyer Hall.
Meyer Hall.
Not in the Joy Center.
Thank you.
Because we will be having film clips from performances that I've done.